Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, November 30th, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the oral arguments of Cyan v. Beaver County Employees Retirement Fund. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Paul Watkins, Civil Litigation Division Chief at the Office of the Arizona Attorney General. After remarks from Paul, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. On Tuesday, November 28th, the court heard oral argument in Cyan v. Beaver County Employees Retirement Fund, which is a case arising from the California Supreme Court. The question presented in Cyan is whether state courts lack subject matter jurisdiction over covered class actions that allege only claims under the Securities Act of 1933. I'll give a brief procedural and statutory overview before moving into the key interpretive dispute. Three pension funds brought a class action suit in California State Court against Cyan, which is a computer software company. The class action alleged violations of the 33 Act based upon alleged misstatements in Cyan's offering documents. Cyan moved for judgment on the pleadings, arguing that Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act of 98, SLUSA, eliminated state court jurisdiction over covered class actions asserting claims under only the Securities Act. A covered class action is a class including more than 50 plaintiffs. The Superior Court denied Cyan's motion. Cyan then filed for a writ of mandate in California's Court of Appeal, which was denied without petition, and the California Supreme Court denied discretionary review. And as we all know now, the Cyan hit the jackpot and the Supreme Court granted cert. Now, the interpretation of the language in this case could turn substantially on the history behind the statute because, as we'll get into, the language itself is not at all clear. So I want to go over the history of that statute just a little bit. In fact, this was a big focus for petitioners. At one point, Justice Kagan said, shouldn't we get to the text of the statute before we talk about the purpose? So the purpose is probably the strongest argument that petitioners have in this case. SLUSA was essentially designed to reinforce the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 95, which is known as the PSLRA, by eliminating loopholes that securities plaintiffs were exploiting to circumvent the 95 Act. The PSLRA was designed to address rampant abuse of private securities class actions, quote, rampant abuse, as the court noted in Merrill Lynch versus Dabbitt. The act was passed by bipartisan majorities over President Clinton's veto, and it imposed a number of significant reforms on securities class actions. What's interesting is that prior to the PSLRA, virtually all securities litigation was filed in federal court and asserted federal claims. There does not appear to be a single example of a case involving federal claims being filed in state court, and mixed federal and state claims before the PSLRA were very rare. Because the PSLRA applies only in federal court and none of its provisions apply to state claims, the securities plaintiffs bar began filing actions in state court and began filing state law claims. In response to this shift to state courts, Congress enacted SLUSA in 98, which includes a few important provisions. And here, it would probably be helpful to have a blackboard or some type of visual because I'm going to be referring back to these provisions. First, there's a preclusion provision in Section 16B. This is a provision that it's incorporated by reference, the petitioners allege, it is incorporated by reference, some form of it, into Section 22A. But so there's a preclusion provision in Section 16B. It prohibits state law claims concerning fraud in covered class actions involving covered securities, which are those traded on a national stock exchange. Congress further amended the concurrent jurisdiction provision of Section 22A. This is the provision that is primarily at issue in this case. This provision was amended to read that district courts shall have jurisdiction concurrent with state and territorial courts, and here's the key phrase, except as provided in Section 16 with respect to covered class actions of all suits in equity and actions at law brought to enforce any liability or duty created by this chapter. There's also an anti-removal provision in Section 22A that's the focus of the Solicitor General's argument. That reads, that was amended to read, except as provided in Section 16B, no case arising under this subchapter and brought in any state court of competent jurisdiction shall be removed to any court of the United States. And I just want to repeat the key phrase in Section 22A and then go into the different interpretations of that provision. Section 22A again says, the district courts shall have jurisdiction concurrent with state and territorial courts, except as provided in Section 16 with respect to covered class actions. Now, petitioners argue that this except as provided in Section 16 language eliminates state court jurisdiction over all 33 Act claims for covered class actions, those, again, with more than 50 class members. Respondents argue that 22A precludes state court jurisdiction only for mixed claims where plaintiffs assert claims under both the 33 Act and state law. The Solicitor General agreed with respondents that this section 22A does not preclude concurrent state court jurisdiction over pure 33 Act suits, but the Solicitor General contends that 22A provides that defendants may remove 33 Act claims to federal court. Respondents, of course, disagree that removal is possible, while petitioners say the U.S. position is a fine backup if the court doesn't want to go as far as we're requesting. All of these interpretations have substantial problems. It's hard to tell where the court will go. The justices, I think, were unusually direct in expressing their displeasure with how the statute was drafted. I've written down some of the quotes here. They called it gibberish multiple times, gibberish all the way down, obtuse, a road to nowhere. Justice Alito at one point says the statute is so incoherent, maybe we should deny its effect entirely. Quote, is there a point at which we say this means nothing? We can't figure out what it means, and therefore it has no effect. It means nothing. Against this backdrop, each of the three sides advance interpretations that have their own flaws. The main strength of each interpretation is probably that it does not have the flaws of the other interpretations. Let me get to those interpretations now. And what I'm going to try to do here is gloss in discussing each interpretation, explain how each side is sort of changing the language. I'll try to do this in a way that's fair. I'm not saying that they're rewriting the language, but this is sort of the way the language would be written to give the clearest effect to the purpose that each side is advancing. So petitioners are essentially saying that this language should read, except as to covered class actions as defined in Section 16. So the language that originally says, except as provided in Section 16 with respect to covered class actions. Okay, what does except as provided in Section 16 mean? The petitioners are saying, well, it means as defined in Section 16, and therefore any class action that is a covered class action, then a state court does not have concurrent jurisdiction over that class action. During the argument, the three justices who seemed most skeptical of this view were Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Ginsburg. It was hard to tell which justice was most supportive. It seemed that they all had significant questions. There are some advantages to the petitioner's interpretation that they pointed out in oral argument, the primary one being that this is the most faithful interpretation to the history and the purposes of SELUSA. It was intended to prevent evasion of the PSLRA. This interpretation would clearly give effect to that purpose. It also excludes real cases from state court jurisdictions, as we will see from the respondent's interpretation. The effect of respondent's interpretation would really not exclude any cases that would actually be brought. The final advantage is that this interpretation does not make availability of a federal forum for defendants turn on whether plaintiffs have pled a claim that was already precluded under Section 16. Now, there are some disadvantages in the interpretation of petitioners. Petitioners are reading as provided in Section 16 to mean as defined in Section 16, which is a somewhat strained and unusual reading of this language. Justice Kagan had a lot of questions about this particular interpretive move. I think that petitioners were unable to come up with a parallel that persuaded Justice Kagan that this sort of formulation was used elsewhere in the U.S. Code. Another problem is that this interpretation of excluding cases from state court jurisdiction is broader than the provisions in the this interpretation results in exclusions from state court jurisdiction that are not limited to covered securities and are not limited to fraud, and are therefore not symmetric to the preclusion or removal provisions in Section 16. And there's no clear reason why there would be differences, why this exclusion from jurisdiction would be broader than the preclusion and removal provisions. And there's also a concern that since the effect of this interpretation is to displace state court jurisdiction, that should not occur on ambiguous language as is present here. And Justice Ginsburg kicked off the argument by noting, look, if you're right, petitioners, if this is what Congress intended, well, they should have written the statute this way. They should have said federal courts shall have exclusive jurisdiction over covered class actions asserting violations of this subchapter. Let me move on to the respondent's interpretation. The respondents essentially read the statute as saying, except for covered class actions that are precluded by Section 16B. Now, Section 16B precludes class actions alleging state law claims. So there seems no purpose to then repeat that the effect of that preclusion in Section 22A and remove those cases from state court jurisdiction. However, there are some advantages with respondents' interpretation. It reads as provided in Section 16 to require that Section 16 actually provide something rather than merely define a term. It reads Section 22A to be symmetric with Section 16B, and it's also sensitive to federalism concerns of displacing state court jurisdiction. The disadvantage, as I noted earlier, is that it renders the entire except as provided in Section 16 to be superfluous and not actually precluding any concurrent jurisdiction, since mixed cases are already precluded by Section 16B, and it is thus pointless to plead a mixed suit. Now, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Ginsburg, Justice Gorsuch in particular, had very intense questioning of the respondents on this point. At some point during questions from Justice Ginsburg, the respondents were struggling to explain why their interpretation was not a road to nowhere that really had no effect. There's one other strange result from the respondent's interpretation, and that is it makes the question of whether there is federal court jurisdiction turn on whether state law claims are simultaneously raised, state law claims that are hopelessly precluded under Section 16B. Also, this interpretation may not be as consistent with the history of SLUSA because it does still allow this loophole where federal claims can be brought in state court. Turning finally to the Solicitor General's interpretation, now this interpretation focuses on a different provision of Section 22A, and that is the anti-removal provision of Section 22A. And I'll read that provision again, which I mentioned at the beginning. The anti-removal provision reads, except as provided in Section 16B, no case arising under this subchapter and brought in any state court of competent jurisdiction shall be removed to any court of the United States. The natural question, of course, is what is provided in Section 16. Section 16C states, any covered class action brought in any state court involving a covered security is set forth in Section B shall be removable to the federal district court for the district in which the action is pending and shall be subject to subsection B. The key phrase in subsection C is the reference to subsection B, and that reference is as set forth in subsection B. The key question about that phrase is what does it modify? What is set forth in subsection B? If Section B is used to define covered class action, then only class actions involving state causes of action can be removed. Of course, this doesn't make sense because those causes of action are precluded, so they can't be heard by federal courts either. They're precluded under Section B. They can't be heard by state or federal courts. So the government says that involving a covered security is the term being defined in Subsection B. And a class action involves a covered security if there is a covered security and the type of fraudulent allegations regarding misstatements or misrepresentations described in B1 and B2 are present, and those relate to statements of fraud or manipulative devices. Now let me turn to the advantages of this interpretation. The advantages are this reads as set forth in subsection B as modifying the phrase directly before it, which is generally a good interpretive principle. It limits removal of state court jurisdiction to the same restrictions as the rest of SLUSA, covered class actions alleging fraud relating to covered securities. It does not have unexplained expansion of SLUSA's coverage. And it's more respectful of state court jurisdiction by relying on optional removal rather than outright denial of state court jurisdiction. It's also consistent with SLUSA's history and purpose. There are some disadvantages. One of them, Mr. Goldstein pointed out on behalf of the respondents, is that this argument received little to no emphasis in his opinion in the Solicitor General's brief, and indicates that this textual argument and indicates that they were struggling to come up with a strong position. Let me deal with the disadvantages. The disadvantage is that it selects which part of Section 16B are incorporated by the cross reference in 16C. Without a very strong textual basis for doing so. It hinges all on that phrase involving, and the Solicitor General's office went back and forth with the court trying to persuade them that involving was a term that was tied to subsections 1 and 2 dealing with the fraud and manipulative device limitations. This is necessary because Section B is specifically limited to state causes of action, and the government is, in one view, essentially reading that limitation out of the statute. Another disadvantage with the government's position, which came up at oral argument, is that this interpretation essentially renders the first except as provided in Section 16, the phrase that is the primary dispute between the petitioners and respondents, essentially renders this first phrase a nullity and does not have a good explanation of why it was included by Congress. Justice Alito, in a somewhat humorous, humorous portion of the transcript, stated that he thought the Solicitor General's interpretation was so far from reality that it, quote, really strains credulity. He did not believe that anyone in Congress intended to have the interpretation that was being advanced by the Solicitor General's office. Then finally, Justice Kennedy indicated that maybe the court shouldn't address removal since this is not a removal case. As I indicated at the beginning, this case came up through the state courts. Cyan did not attempt to remove to federal court. So is it really appropriate for the Supreme Court to step out and base their ruling on a procedural issue that did not arise in this matter? So with that, I'll conclude my summary of the argument, and I would be very glad to take any questions.
Let's go to audience question and answer. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first audience question.
I want to follow up on your comments about the Solicitor General's position. I think that you're absolutely right that normally the court does not even address an issue that was not raised by the parties, and it would seem to me that the right to remove isn't even relevant to the outcome of this case, and that therefore it would be pure dicta if they addressed it. Was there any support at all on the court for adopting the government's position, or would the more likely outcome be that the court doesn't even address the issue?
Well, it's a little hard to tell from the argument, again, just based on the fact that each position seemed to receive more criticism than support. I would say the two justices who were most interested in the government's position were Justice Breyer. Justice Breyer went through a long line of questions where and he seemed to be somewhat persuaded by the government's textual argument. At least at one point, he stopped asking questions about it. And then Justice Gorsuch seemed somewhat favorably inclined toward it. Interestingly, there was not much comment from Justice Thomas, of course, but also not from from Justice Roberts. So I think the direction that those two are leaning could probably swing this.
We have another caller lined up, so let's go to our next question.
Hi, I wanted to ask, what do you think the long-term and short-term effects are if the court rules in favor of petitioners and vice versa, respondents? Long-term effects as in the effect on securities litigation?
Right. Right. Well, and that's a very good question, and I think why this case has attracted so much attention. I think if the ruling is in favor of respondents, probably not a lot changes. If the ruling is in favor of petitioners, then I think these 33 Act cases would not be brought in state court. They could still be brought in federal court, but whatever advantage is perceived as being obtained from state court would not be present. So I think it's probably no accident that this case came out of California. California may be one of the jurisdictions, I think empirically is one of the jurisdictions where these cases are commonly filed, and there are a few others around the country. So those jurisdictions would see fewer of these cases. I guess whether there are fewer cases filed overall, I think for a meritorious case, it really shouldn't matter whether it's filed in federal or state court, but maybe for some cases that are on the margins, they may not be filed.
I'll make another call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, December 1st at 3 p.m. That call will be on recent developments in corporate mergers and will feature our teleforum regular, Professor Richard A. Epstein, Professor of Law and Director of the Classic Liberal Institute at New York University School of Law. I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, I can ask one of my own. Paul, were there any surprises in the oral argument?
You know, I was surprised not to hear more questioning from Justice Roberts, particularly based on his extremely strong background in corporate law, obviously has a background in just about all areas of law, but I was surprised that he was not more active in oral argument. This really looks like a case where, honestly, I don't see it's hard for me to predict where five votes would come from, and I wonder if there will be five or if there will be a series of opinions in this case.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, would you like to make any final remarks?
I think I've said everything I have to say. Thank you so much for providing this forum, and thank you to the folks who listened in.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.